Sometimes when I'm like falling asleep at night, I'll just go through like the memories of my dad. Because the saddest thing would be like, I can't remember that anymore. Because I just have a handful of them.
When I see pictures or I hear things, it's just sort of like a, oh, I wonder what would have been. That's all I can feel, is I wonder what would have been.
Love me tender, love me sweet, never let me go.
I remember going to the beach with my dad and riding the little Shetland ponies.
You have made my life complete, and I love you so.
It's like a Rolodex. I'll flip through. I'm like, oh yeah, there's the snow. There's the gravestone. And then hearing my dad's voice like, what are you doing? Like, nothing.
Those are the voices of Rachel and Kelly O'Toole and of their father, the late Fran O'Toole. It is 40 years since Fran was killed after the Miami show band was lured into a paramilitary ambush in County Down in Northern Ireland. I'm Susan McKay. I was a teenager in Derry in 1975. For my generation, music was a wonderful escape from the daily reality of the conflict that was engulfing the North. That year, Rachel was 4 and a half, Kelly just 3. They were growing up in the seaside resort of Bray, County Wicklow, in the Republic. They are trying to capture memories of their lost father.
I remember sitting by the windows playing, waiting for my dad to come back home. Like, I just had sort of knew that he was kind of like this guy that would work a lot. I remember the very, very, very first time I ever saw snow in my entire life. He must have come home or something, because I have this like direct memory of him throwing a snowball at me at the window, and it like came like right at my face and like shattered across the glass.
I've traveled to Canada to meet the O'Tooles. I don't know yet if Rachel and Kelly's mother, Valerie, will talk to me. She and her daughters don't see each other. It's complicated.
Oh, we were supposed to look at this carving.
Rachel has followed her father into showbiz.
Are you guys carving away our rooftop?
She works in Vancouver's thriving film industry, and she takes me on a tour of the film set she's working on.
It's going to get hard-coated, so we wanted to do some deep stuff to, after it's hard-coated, it'll come up less.
So the hard-coating will cover it up like by a quarter of an inch or something? No, an eighth of an inch, something like that?
It's pretty thin. This.
I am a production designer. I work on television and films. I work together with the producers and the directors to create the world that tells the story. And it's a great job. It's such a great job.
We have a bunch of them to do. 30 of them to do, or 15.
I live in a pretty high-end and edgy part of Vancouver. I really do love living here. It's got beautiful mountains and beaches and fresh air and a good culture, lots of great food. I call Paul my unmarried husband. We've been together almost 7 years. He's from Northern Ireland.
Dan.
Almost done.
Yeah, almost done. A couple more. Then.
Yay!
Okay. Kelly lives in a suburban town with her husband Dustin and their 2 young sons. She is artistic too. For now, though, her focus is on raising the boys.
We live in Langley. Langley is very central to 20 minutes from the beach, 25, 30 minutes from the city, 25 minutes from the U.S. border. We live in a nice, quiet neighborhood where you're within walking distance to stores, parks, the school, things like that. Lots of kids in the neighborhood, so it's quite good for the little ones. Yeah, it's fairly comfortable. We like it.
Rachel and Kelly have been gone from Ireland since shortly after their father's death. They scarcely remember Bray. Their cousin David was 10 in 1975. His father, Michael, was Fran's older brother. David still lives not far from the town. He is Rachel and Kelly's strongest link with the past.
My grandfather, Mick, had a mix of amusements down at the end of the Albert Walk. My grandmother played the piano, was quite musical. It was only a small family, but tight-knit. They grew up in the fairgrounds, I think. So it was very much that kind of background. It was kind of a showbiz kind of feeling about the family that I always got.
Fran's parents kept a box of their son's old papers in their attic, and Fran's brother Michael kept it safe after they died. David sends some of the documents with me to Canada.
He's definitely got the hairstyle of somebody who was in a band. This must have been when they were in the Chosen Few.
Yeah.
Like, it's got that, it has that style.
Kelly and Rachel are fascinated by the photos and diaries I've brought from Ireland.
Why does this feel like something you would draw in elementary school? It looks like a school book that he's doodled all over, and that's funny because I am a doodler. I'm Rachel O'Doodles. Oh.
So this is where I get the crease in my forehead, like that little
furrow thing. You see it right there? Nobody wrote any information on the back of photographs at this time, huh? You must be, what, 16, 17 here? I got four slaps today for failing my science and missing Latin. There's a lot of slaps. So it was allowed, you were allowed to slap children in school, I guess.
Well, back in the day, of course.
Sorry, you went to school in Tipperary?
He went to boarding school.
All the way in Tipperary?
All the way in Tipperary.
For his daughters, the main connection with Fran has been through his music. Thin Lizzy's Phil Lynott called him Ireland's best soul singer. In 1968, when Fran was just 22, he'd been invited to join the Miami Show Band, one of the most popular in the country.
I didn't even know your name.
His arrival changed and modernised the band's style. As his nephew David remembers it, Fran's star was on the rise and he was loving it.
He drove a purple Ford Capri. It was quite a flash car. You'd always know it was Fran's car driving around Bray when you've seen it. Very proud of it, I think. I always remember going out with the two girls and with Fran, and they had a big Alsatian dog, so we would go out for walks in the Dublin Mountains, that kind of thing.
I remember rainbows being so bright that they looked like they were painted on the sky with fluorescent paint. I remember going for Whippies, right? Is that what they're called, Whippies? Or 99s, 99ers.
We used to go down the seafront all the time with the girls, and they'd have, you know, 99s. My grandparents' house was the kind of hub of the family, and that's where we would meet most of the time.
I remember hanging around with my grandmother in the kitchen and her teaching me how to peel an apple.
All our songwriting was basically done in Fran's house, in his mother's house, actually.
That's Des Lee, the Miami's saxophonist. He and Fran wrote some of the Miami's great romantic pop songs together, and they were close friends.
And his mother used to make us the most gorgeous apple tarts.
Fran hadn't left behind the music he'd been so passionate about before he found fame and fortune on the showband circuit.
Fran was a big soul fan. He had a very good soul voice. His first band, The Chosen Few, were very much a soul band. They played support to The Who in the stadium at about 1965, 66. I think that's where his real passion lay.
For now, though, the Miami was hugely successful and Fran was having a ball.
Well, we were known as the Irish Beatles. The Miami in the north was massive. It was massive everywhere. I mean, if you look at, for example, you can see photographs today of the band, for example, playing in the Arcadia Ballroom in Bray, where Fran lived, and there would be 2,000 people inside and 2,000 people outside, and they were screaming and shouting. Oh, it was good times.
Fran was working six nights a week, zigzagging all over Ireland with the Miami. But everyone knew his ambition was to go solo, and in 1971, he auditioned for RTE's Reach for the Stars, the X Factor of its day. He was one of 60 performers selected to compete in the show.
Yeah, I remember the night he was on Reach for the Stars. It was really exciting. Live on TV with all the family together. Kelly and Rachel were there that night as well. Kelly would have been just a little baby, so maybe she wasn't in the room with all the excitement. But I certainly remember Rachel being there. And the excitement of him winning the competition was incredible.
He fully deserved to win the show. And from there on, it's Fran just took off.
David has discovered some old tapes which his uncle Fran must have recorded while he rehearsed at home in Bray. Rachel and Kelly are excited when I play them in Vancouver. They haven't heard them before.
What do you do when you are lonely? What do you do when you are sad?
You have to give me these recordings. They're fun. Yeah. I really like this kind of analog, random sound. Is that you? You're kidding? This is totally my sound. That's pretty much what if I was playing, I would be sitting around doing. Yeah. It's really nice. It's very actually what's happening now in music, like laid back.
As she listens to these old recordings from decades ago, Rachel's thoughts turn to her mother.
My mother talks about it like it's Romeo and Juliet. It's like she's got it in a golden bubble with nothing wrong. You know, and whose relationship doesn't have anything wrong with it? But she loved him an incredible, incredible amount. They met really, really early, which means that their love was kind of, you know, hopped up on hormones and excitement and fantasy. Like, we all know our first love and how intense that is. And so she got to marry her first love and make babies with him. I think they had good times. It's just a bunch of lines.
Well, no, it's a thing to do with this music and the Miami show band.
Is it?
Yeah, I think it's like...
Oh, I guess this was like a work contract. An agreement made on the something September 1967. Yeah, I think at the time, like, getting this job was pretty kick-ass, I think. And, you know, got instant notoriety, joining a band that was probably already pretty popular. So you get to be paid as a musician, you get to do something that you love for a living. I have a great picture of them on an airplane together, where my mother looks absolutely, like, purely happy. Like, it's actually very sad, because she just looks like, they're sitting in a plane, and she's looking out, and someone just turned and took a photograph of them. And, it's like, it's one of those photos where you look at it and you're like, she has no idea what's coming. It's really sad.
Our last gig was in the Castle Ballroom in Banbridge. That was our last gig before the massacre.
Banbridge is in the part of Northern Ireland known as Mid Ulster. Such was the level of killings in the area during the 1970s that it earned the chilling title of the Murder Triangle. But it was also great dancing country.
It was a wonderful, wonderful gig. You know, you see, during those terrible times in Northern Ireland, the one thing that we enjoyed doing was giving our fans 2 hours to get away from all the troubles, 2 hours to have some fun, to laugh, sing and dance. And we were so happy to put so many smiles on so many faces during that horrible time. We finished the gig in Banbridge. It was probably around about, 2 o'clock in the morning. We would normally go and speak to the fans, sign autographs, give them photographs of the band. We got in the van and we were heading down towards Dublin. And we noticed this roadblock, which we thought was the normal roadblock that we had been so used to. and we were pulled over. We're asked to get out of the van, which we did. We were lined up against the ditch, and we were asked several questions, which was what was normal at these roadblocks. But what was actually happening was that two of the gang were going to the van and they were putting a 10-pound bomb into our van, which we didn't know about. And then there was a massive explosion. The bomb exploded prematurely, killing the two terrorists and blowing me off my feet straight into the field. And I was laying down on the field. I pled dead. There was massive gunfire going all around me. There was screaming. And it was all over within a matter of 5 minutes. And I just heard running. I heard one guy actually saying, "Are all those bastards dead?" The gang had gone. And I tried to call out the guys' names. And I called out Fran. I got no response. Brian, no response. And Tony, no response. I called out Stephen's name and he was moaning.
That day, that night, that event, I lost, like, that was the day my father stopped loving me. And that was the day that my mother became incapable of loving me. That was the day I no longer had the love of my grandmother or anyone else. That our family, if you imagine it as like one unit, it completely broke through that one event. And none of the pieces could ever go back together again.
People all over the world were shocked by the murders of these young musicians.
Even to this day, I have never seen a bigger funeral in all my life. The whole of Bray was at a standstill. It was a massive funeral. And I'll never forget Fran's father, God rest him. When Fran was been lowered into the grave and Fran's father went over to the grave and nearly fell in. I think he might have wanted to fall in on top of Fran. That's how cut up his father was. It was absolutely awful, awful day.
Des is haunted by those terrible events. Rachel and Kelly don't remember them. However, they have spent a lot of time searching the internet for traces of their father. On one such trawl, Rachel has found footage of his funeral.
It's like this big limousine comes down and this big progression, and then they cut to like kind of like the coffin being held by the pallbearers. I think Des is there and my Uncle Michael, and you see like our mother like totally out of it. She's medicated to high heaven, so depressed looking, but removed completely. And you see the grief in my grandmother's face, the grief in my grandfather. I think he's collapsing.
He collapses on the coffin.
Yeah, and my Uncle Michael's trying to like pick him up. And you're like, this is my entire family. Like all the people we never saw again are all collectively involved in this screen over this like white little coffin.
You don't even really know what you're feeling when you watch it. You know?
That's a good way to put it.
Yeah. You just sort of...
There's no one single emotion.
Yeah. And then it's a reminder of how, you know, those are all your family members that you never saw again as a group.
Yeah.
Or not only saw, but we weren't even given back history, as in stories or anything like that. It was just a complete cutoff, completely.
All that Rachel remembers from that time is that people changed towards her.
I do remember this, is that everybody at some point changed and started looking at me differently, and it feels like they were looking at me from within doorways.
Their father was gone, and the lives of the little O'Toole girls were about to take a further dramatic turn.
My mother went on a sort of relief trip away to Spain with one of her girlfriends because it was so busy at the time with journalists and I don't know what was going on, just a lot of concern and grief and chaos with everybody. She met another man there, and they decided after 2 days to get engaged and to move to Canada and take us with them. She introduced him as, "This is your new dad," or "This is your new father." And,
here was a stranger that was now playing the role of, you know, and now this new man is playing the role of your father. I'm like, okay.
I knew that that Valerie was remarrying. I met her new husband, and then suddenly they were gone. Now that it's over, there was no goodbyes, they were just gone. I don't. Time to say goodbye. I'm sorry that I took your time
with a poem that didn't rhyme. I think we moved to Canada, it was like April 2nd, 1976. So not, that's what my immigration papers say. It was just like we just like dropped a pin somewhere and that's where we ended up, you know. But I think for my mother it was quiet, isolated. You know, not a lot of, you wouldn't expect someone to come in the middle of the night and do anything bad to you, so.
She described it as her mother's decision was like joining a witness protection program. She just wanted out of the situation in Ireland.
One of the tapes David found was of his uncle Fran rehearsing James Taylor's Fire and Rain. Although the recording quality is poor, hearing their father singing the song evokes particular memories for Rachel and Kelly.
Woke up this morning, never sleep. I got a pain in my head. Nothing new and nothing bad, but I'm feeling sad again. La da 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 da
da da da da da da da da da da da. We can't listen to this one. This is a weird one.
I see fire, I see rain.
A memory of whenever I was younger, hearing his music would always be in our mother's darkest moments. So there's always that connection for me. It's almost not a happy thing.
But I always thought that I'd see you again.
She played the music, but it was always during just sad times. It wasn't like a celebration. It was just the sad stuff, you know. She would tell us that he'd, you know, been blown up and that his toes flew over his head or some strange imagery like that. No visions of the future or goals that he had for us or anything like that.
We knew our dad was killed. We did not know how. All we had heard was shot and blown up. And as a child, you couldn't understand how that there was a connection there, but you didn't ask.
In Ireland, after his death, Fran's first solo single was released and went straight to the top of the charts. His album followed soon afterwards. This was painful for Fran's mother, Mary. Heartbroken, she had stopped going out.
He was being talked about all the time, but he wasn't actually around.
Smile on sunshine, smile on.
What was before a celebration for my grandparents of hearing him on the radio, when she was stuck in the house by herself and this music was being played all the time, must have been very difficult for her. She lived for Fran and the two kids. Fran's death and missing the two girls, I think, was just too much for her. She never seen him again. She died 3 years later.
Des Lee saw Fran as a brother. He was one of those who were shocked by the choices Valerie had made.
Been as close as I was to Fran. I was very cut up at the time that Valerie got involved with another man so soon after Fran's death. When I look back on it now, it's her life. And I can't tell her what to do, but I was very caught up with that now, to be honest.
Well, we all know she wasn't handling it very well, but who could? Who could ever handle that well?
Her daughters understand now, but Valerie's grieving for Fran dominated their girlhood.
Our house was a fend for herself house, so everybody did what they could to just get through. So there was no bonds, like, you're just isolated.
It was dark. My sister and I were just so isolated. Like, we were pretty much strangers to one another, just kids, like, floating alone, like, on little inner tubes out in the middle of a huge ocean, just trying to figure out, like, why nothing felt normal, but didn't know any different. Until we went back to Ireland when I was 15 and she was 13. My uncle Michael had come out from Ireland. He just sort of showed up at the doorstep. And here was this person from Ireland again. And he kind of convinced my mother to let us come back for the summer. We spent the summer there. So we got it to become a little bit familiar with each other. And we got to see our family again.
It was great to see them again. And we just clicked like there had been no separation at all.
Kelly recalls this as a turning point in their lives.
My uncle Michael was a huge influence in our lives. I solely count my relationship with my sister, Rachel, to my uncle Michael from that time that we stayed in his home.
The sisters made a second and longer visit to Ireland in the early 1990s. They grew closer to the O'Toole family and to memories of their father.
And so when I got to be 21, I just said, like, that's it. I'm sick of this. I'm sick of everybody. I'm going to go back to Ireland and, like, reclaim my happiness. And Kelly came as well. And we lived in my Uncle Michael's house and hung out with David and our cousin Nick. And we sort of, if he hadn't done that, like, I don't think that my sister Kelly and I would ever talk. Like, I just don't think. I think that everything was just drifting further and further away. And that kind of, like, brought us back together. They were great. They were really good to us. And that was kind of refreshing because we had, that was unusual. That was unusual.
I don't think if it wasn't for that time spent, we wouldn't be as close as we are now. Like, mm-hmm. We talk quite a lot.
Yep.
Which shows me, I'm like, just a small time with the family. Imagine what would have happened if we were raised like that.
How much more awesome could we have become?
Relations with their mother have never recovered, and for many years, neither of Valerie's daughters have seen her, though Rachel does talk with her occasionally by phone. Valerie does not join us as Rachel and Kelly listen to Fran's recordings.
If I were a rich man now, would you love me anyhow? Singing all the times I know.
It's a very strange thing, but every time I imagine the memories of my dad in my mind, he's wearing the exact same outfit. Like, every scenario, when we're at the beach with the horses, when he's throwing snowball at the window, he's wearing the outfit from the album. So I can't, but maybe he always wore a denim shirt and jeans and this belt. But I remember him shirtless. Yeah, in the backyard. So I guess there's two outfits. One topless, one not. It's just someone who was there and then wasn't there. It's strange because now I'm so much older than he ever was. Like, he died when he was 29.
More so than listening to the music. It was really weird for me the first time I ever saw that video of RTE where he actually spoke. That was weird for me.
Oh, which one?
Where he spoke with the audience and he asked them to pick a song.
Fran recorded this program, Me and My Music, early in the summer of 1975. Uniquely in his archive, it features him speaking as well as singing. By the time it was broadcast, he was dead.
Thank you very much. Thank you. I'm sure every songwriter is asked at some stage, how do you write a song? Well, not that I consider myself a songwriter, but I do write some songs. So I'll tell you, sometimes you have an idea. You might have an idea. You might get an idea from somebody else, you see, about a thing to write about. But somebody give us a title for a song and see, can I do anything with it? Give us some title. Anybody? Paperback Writer. That is a song. But I'll do my own version, okay? I'll try. Just give you an idea how you approach a song, right? Paperback Writer.
for me, that was the first time I've ever heard him speak, as opposed to just singing a song.
Yeah, there's always that. You're always, like, familiar with the music.
And... yeah, so it was kind of like a...
Oh, right,
he was a person.
Alas, here's a song I didn't write myself, but I wish I did, because it's one of my favorite songs. It's an old traditional song, and nobody knows who wrote it. It's my own arrangement. It's called The Leaving of Liverpool.
Fare thee well, my own, my love. I am going far away. I'm bound for California, and I know.
We missed out on a lot. We lost our heritage, we lost our family, we lost a lot of different things, and it doesn't matter if that was one day ago or if it was 40 years ago, we still deal with it to this day.
When you start to grow up and you see other people that have kids and how they treat their kids and how their kids are running towards their family members and they're hugging and laughing, and so when you begin to see that, the relationship between, you know, fathers and daughters, or parents, or just any family, grandparents, you see how real that is, and you look at it with this, like, it's like you're listening to another language, and you're like, but I kind of understand that, but you have this, like, really deep, deep sadness, and this shame that you've been so naive that you didn't understand that that's what the world was like, that kind of, that there was love in the world like that.
So Dusty and I have been together 20 years or something. And when I had first met him, he's very close with his family. I remember saying to him, I'm like, I have no intention of ever meeting them. And if you're looking for the type of girl that's going to Sunday dinners, that is not me. So let me know now. He's like, okay. And I ended up meeting them, and it's all good. But that's literally how I felt. And I had to work really hard to form connections with people.
Valerie has decided that she doesn't want to meet up, but she does agree to take a short phone call from us.
I'll turn it up.
Hello?
Hi, it's Rachel and Susan.
Okay.
Can you tell Susan, like, I know it's, you know, if for you it feels as real today as it happened yesterday,
yeah.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah, it does. It doesn't get any better, and time does not heal all wounds. Like, I still dream about Fran and everything, so...
You do?
Yeah. And it's horrible when you wake up and he's not here and you don't know what you're doing here.
You've said before that, you never get used to that person being gone, right? You expect them to keep coming home.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You do. You definitely do. When Fran was killed, I went to bed. I still never got put back together again, really.
Valerie has a memory of a date with Fran back in 1969.
We went to see Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. And when I came out of the cinema, I was crying.
Mm-hmm.
And Fran said, that only happens in movies. That doesn't happen in real life. And I've never forgot that, because it did happen in real life.
One of the most shocking aspects of the Miami massacre is the fact that members of the security forces were part of the Loyalist murder gang. This continues to outrage Valerie.
Britain's done enough to Ireland for years and years and years and years. Now, to find out that they're even involved in something like that in this day and age, they ought to be ashamed of themselves. They really ought to. I mean, my God... just makes me so mad. Really does.
40 years on from the murder of her young husband, Valerie is taking a case against the British government. Michael Flanagan is her solicitor.
When we're looking at the documents and you see the lists of objects recovered at the scene, you know, and it includes, you know, a sparkly jacket and a pair of platform boots, and you just realise just how kind of vulnerable these young men were. The civil proceedings are being taken against the Ministry of Defence and the Chief Constable of the PSNI, arguing that the Ministry of Defence is vicariously liable for the actions of its soldiers. In addition, the Ministry of Defence is being sued for its admissions policy to the UDR, which we will argue was a negligent policy in admitting loyalist paramilitaries, and also that the then RUC failed in their role vetting membership of the UDR.
Rachel and Kelly are not involved in the case, but despite the distance between them and their mother, they support what she is doing.
I think it's a worthwhile cause. I don't think that it's okay to completely destroy people's lives, the paths of their lives. And I don't think it's okay to plan people's murders and leave their family stranded. And I don't think it's fine that you can just take a father away from their children and a husband away from a wife and think that they can grow up okay. I think if the case makes people aware that our lives are all still being affected by this, that it doesn't just go away in a 48-hour news cycle or whatever, it doesn't go away because nobody wants to talk about the facts because it's inconvenient to a political agenda, or, you know, people are sort of tired of it in the news and they want to move on and we should just get over it. Like, that's not happening, because every day we wake up, our life has been built upon the structure of this event, and it shaped it.
Neither Kelly nor Rachel has any desire to return to Ireland. However, Valerie feels very differently.
Yeah. Would you move back to Ireland? If you could?
I think so, yeah, I would.
What would be the perfect place for you to live in?
Oh, God, is my dream place to live in?
Yeah.
It would be Bray.
Des Lee has no doubt but that Fran was destined for greatness.
I know that Fran would have made it, because he had everything to be a success. He had the brilliant musician, brilliant songwriter, brilliant keyboard player, great singer. He had everything, but it wasn't to be. If you could see me talking all about
you. After the music, Fran's daughters must find a place for their father in their lives without him. Before I leave Vancouver, Rachel has something to show me.
Right over here by the front door, but not directly. My dad's album cover, the one that was starting off of his solo career. But above it is a little drawing that my nephew, so my sister's firstborn son, Declan, drew. It's a little handprint with a heart inside of it. And it's nice to know that, you know, this sort of picture of my dad, which can be kind of sad, that there's a nice little picture above it of his grandson they never got to meet, but who makes our lives very happy. Don't let the cloud spoil your view.